right and wrong. They're wise and unwise. And too often Christians think only black, white, right, wrong. But there's other grids, and here's a wise, unwise, and also teaches you that really godly Christians can have differences of opinion on what's wise. They had such a sharp disagreement, they parted company. Oh, ouch. Well, here we are, we're talking about collaboration. The first thing I say is we're going to split apart. But I'm not saying, what I'm saying is, look, we just recognize that it's not always simple. Sometimes good intentions, best laid plans, we sometimes say, do you know what, we may have a difference of opinion. Where should we plant a church? That's not right and wrong. That's not moral. It's not, Barnabas is not accused of sinning by Paul. Barnabas, it's a sin against Almighty God if we take John. No, he's saying, Barnabas is not wise. Look at what John Mark did last time. He had a reason for his, like, I don't think that's very wise. And in the book of Acts, if John Mark had gone with them, well, within a chapter, they're severely beaten and thrown in a torture chamber called the dungeon. Who knows whether John Mark would have handled that. But in the providence of God, Barnabas did hang in with John Mark, and later on, as you know all the story. It's easy to read it later, isn't it? We sometimes have to trust God. And in this whole issue of collaborating together, it's not always right and wrong. It's what's wise and what can work at the moment for us and what can work at the moment for you. And we just sometimes have to say, well, isn't it wonderful that God overrules everything for his glory and for the ultimate good of the gospel? We need that encouragement. But you see that the whole idea of collaborating, Paul collaborates with other workers. Some Christian leaders never do. It's my way or the highway. You know, I'm the boss around here. Despite having been hurt by a disagreement about a young man, Paul has not become disillusioned about working with others. Far from it. 16 verse 1, there's a disciple called Timothy, and Paul says, look, we had a disagreement about collaborating last chapter, but I really believe in this team thing. I really believe in working together. I really do believe that teams is the way forward. Now, if that's true in the local church, we're on a bigger team, aren't we? We're on a team that ultimately puts people in heaven. And how can we do that? Well, three thoughts about planting churches, not just growing our own, but planting new churches. There are intentional plants, and some of you are intentional plants. And that's a very exciting thing. We've been involved in, I think, four plants that have worked and two that haven't since I've been a pastor of the church I'm in. And it's a very exciting thing. But they tend to be what we call strawberry plants. The idea of, you know, how strawberry, my brother-in-law was a farmer, he had strawberry fields, and they send out a sucker, and then it kind of, you know, then they send roots down, and then that's how the strawberry plant grows. It sends out suckers. But the geographical reach is, we have 20, 30 people who live over there. So we could put a church over there. And that's how we planted four of our church plants. Two didn't work, two did. But they were strawberry plants. 30 people, 20 people live over there. We'll provide money and a worker and some people. And we, as a single church, plant over there. And that's how many church plants work in this country. And I guess this is how you've planted around here. You're thinking, oh yeah, we have 10 people live over there. Now, over there tends to be, well, it's very rarely 50 miles away, because you don't have that many people live 50 miles away, do you? It might be five. Geography is a funny old thing, isn't it? In the countryside, 5 miles is nothing. In Bristol, that's a long way. There's an awful lot of people between here and 5 miles away. It was out in the Fenland of Cambridge. Yeah, it was probably two farmers. You know, so 5 miles is nothing. So it's not a mileage thing. It's a funny thing. But most plants are like that. They're kind of, you know, over there. Some churches are going now for multi-site churches. You must have come across that. I hesitate to say this. I think it's kind of quite sexy at the moment. Like where it was, I think 10 years ago, it's plant, 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 strawberry plant, strawberry plant, strawberry plant. I've just picked up that some of the large, certainly in Bedford, We've got three very large New Frontiers congregations, you know, very, very passionate about the gospel. But three of them are going multi-site, not plant. They're going multi-site. I want to tell them that is church planting by another door. They don't yet know it. But I do know that because we've done it. And that's what happens. If you multi-site, so we've got a campus here, and we also have our church has another site 3 miles away, but we're all one church under one leadership, and our finances are all shared. Yeah, that will last possibly 10 years. But it won't last much beyond that. That's fine. But it's worth knowing that's what it will become if it grows. Because as soon as new people come, they don't identify with the church, they identify with the congregation they belong to. And as soon as you've got a leader who is not passive, like, I just do what Ray tells me. Like, you know, if you have a proper leader who says, oh, Ray, I've got some great ideas. Anyway, I don't need your say-so. We're going to do this. As soon as you've got a leader like that they become a separate church. And that's fine. But if you don't recognize that, you will find yourself as a church leader multi-siting, becoming a controller. You can't help it. You've got to stick with what we believe. You've got to wear the clothes we wear. You've got to sing the songs we... you can't have that song in your congregation. You know that kind of thing. I mean, in America, as you know, a lot of it is either done... the big man is screened up on the big screen, and we all watch him at the same time, or else he kind of runs around the city preaching 3 or 4 times. Well, that's okay. It's okay. But it's not a long-lasting plan to multi-site. You can do it better in one building. You can have several congregations in one building, and that has less of a tendency to say we are 3 churches in one building, although that can happen. But intentional plants and multi-sites just seems to be planting by another way, and that might be fine. Then you've got the second way of doing it is train and give away. And can I put you've got this ministry training fund. How many of you got a training fund in your church where you put money into the kitty training fund? Okay, a few of you, that's great. Can I plug this big? Let me tell you, I have a friend in my church, he's one of our elders. He is the head of a wills department in a solicitor's company. And he said, Ray, you've got to understand the power of legacies. I said, what do you mean? He said, Ray, people leave money when they die. Often they leave it to dogs' homes. He said, never, ever think those poor little animals, you know, they're going to die because they've not got enough money to be looked after. They are rolling in it, Ray. Do you know? And I know because I write people's wills and I know where they leave it. Let me tell you of a church in Luton. He said, over the years, Ray, it's been left 20 million. Excuse me? How much? He said, over the years, it's been left 20 million. He said, we are the first generation of property owners. What is beginning to happen all around the country is that our parents are dying and leaving an estate, which includes property. For the first time ever, you know, in the past, my granddad died. He just saved up enough for his funeral. He didn't even have enough for a headstone. What did he leave? Well, he left, I've got a grandfather clock up my loft that doesn't work. That was we all got little, you know, all knickknacks, don't you? You've got memorials, that's it. But he didn't, and that would have been true of most of our parents generally, but not now. If our parents die, for many of us now, all of a sudden I'm 50 grand better off because my mum had a house and I've got me and my sister and my brother shared, you know, and the house was worth a couple of hundred thousand And you've got my generation getting little cash windfalls and my generation are beginning to die off too. And average house price in Britain are about 200,000. Some parts of the country it'll be 400,000, 500,000. You find Christians who are, in a sense, cash poor but asset rich make very poor decisions about where they leave their money. And he says, Ray, if you say please leave it to the church, most people are quite nervous of leaving money to the church. Like, oh yeah, so the elders are going to go on a freebie on my mother's lot, you know. And he said, but if you set up a training fund, said this money will go into a dedicated fund to train workers to send out into the harvest field. We had a lady, we set up a training fund, and a lady who we didn't know very well, she's a lovely Christian lady. One of our members looked after her in her advanced old age, and she had been giving a lot of money away through her life. She died. She left our church training fund half her house. We were $250,000 up. Boom, like that. That's astonishing. Since then, we've had other people put money, and they feel more calm, like, if I put it in the training fund, I know what it's going to do. And it's given me the freedom. You know what? It's very difficult if you're a church leader. You want to train up other workers. Now, say you go to a theological college. You meet a really great young guy. And then you go back to a really great young guy. Okay, when's he going to come to preach, Ray? And he comes to preach. Then, okay, when are we going to hear him again? Okay, oh, about 3 months. Okay. And when are we going to interview him? Oh, it's about 6 months' time. When are we going to make a decision? That's about a year's time. He got snapped up 2 weeks after he came to preach at our church. And by the time we make a decision and raise the money, they're gone. It's gone. We need to be able to do what Paul did with Timothy. If you know you've got $250,000 in the bank, you can find a Timothy and say, money, no problem. And you tell the church, this young guy, he's going to come work with us 2 years. He's done some theological training. He's going to have some experience with us, and we're going to give him away. And we're going to give him away to either church revitalize or help in a church plant somewhere. But you can't do that if you have to keep going to the church and say, could we give another £45,000? I don't know what you pay you, but don't pay that much. But you know what I mean? The total cost, by the time you've got pension and holiday and books and phone and all the rest of it, it's a bigger package than just the money. And he said, Ray, will you please start thoughtfully talking about legacies? He said, because Christians can be really good with the money. Is it when their bank balance and absolutely hopeless with their money tied up in their property? And I know this, Ray. And he said, you know, people don't realize just how much they're worth. He tells this incredible story of an old man who was a down and out. His sister died. He inherited the house. He lived in the house for about 7 or 8 years on his own. He come towards the end of his life. He's in hospital. He says, oh, I want to make a will. So a young solicitor goes in. He tells her what she wants. He said, I don't know. My neighbours have been really kind to me. I'll leave it to them. So she writes the will up. He signs it. He dies 2 hours later. So Nick, my friend, has these people come in and said, oh. And he said, it was really funny because the wife was really touchy with the husband because he parked on a single yellow line. And she said, oh, come on, hurry up. Oh, you know, you're going to get a fine. And he's thinking, you don't need to worry. You really don't need to. He said, well, anyway, before I tell you, you are a beneficiary of a will, but before I tell you, you must have known your neighbour really well because he's been very kind to you. And they said, this is what they said, no. We didn't really know him very well at all. All we said was hello over the garden fence every now and then. And Nick said, well, he's left you his whole estate. You are £1.5 million better off. And then said, Nick said, phone up my wife. Louise, talk to the neighbours, talk to the neighbours. But you see, what he's trying to illustrate is this. If people don't plan it, they'll do something like that. And he said, you know, now that has never been a problem in the past. That's why most ordinary people died intestate. They didn't have any estate to leave. But many, many people now own something. And even if they're going to leave it to their children, most of them would say, oh, I'd love to leave 10% to the church. £400,000 house. Church could be £40,000 better off. You still leave the kids a fair whack of inheritance, don't you? You're not going to rob them. And if you inherit, say you're £50,000 off, you could, well, I could tithe that. Okay, I could do something with that money. But yeah, I want. And we've had significant numbers of people say, I came into some money from one recently. He put 10 grand into our training fund because I know his grandfather died and left him 100,000. And he's put 10 grand into the building. Now, if you just give it to the church in general, if you're an accountant, you hate that. I mean, you don't, but you do. Because you love predictability, don't you? If you're an accountant, you want to know how many standing orders have we got? and what comes in regularly. And if someone just throws in 10 grand, go, oh, please don't show the church those figures, because they'll think we're really better off than we really are, because it's all come from a legacy, and they'll all stop giving. You know how accountants work like that, okay? But if you put it in a training fund, you, as a church leadership, begin to get the financial freedom you need to get the Timothys of this world into church leadership. Because that is one of the big headaches, isn't it? The big headache is not necessarily finding them, it's funding them. So big, we've worked hard at this. We had somebody just 6 weeks ago said, I'd like to leave a significant number to the training fund. It was another $250,000. And I'm like, you are joking. Like, that is unbelievable. So look, you can do anything you like. You can draw all down in 1 year if you like, or you could take £25,000 down for the next 10 years. I'm going to leave it with your judgment. Well, that given me and my leadership team tremendous freedom to say, right, because they say, look, we want the gospel to succeed, and we recognize that one of the great ways of doing that is training workers who can go and. So in a sense, we're on a collaborative thing, and those people need training. How do we do that? Well, you have got a ministry training course where we are. Someone might go to college. And that sense of intentionally helping your assistant pastors, collaborating with them, skilling them up, as well as modeling Christian maturity is really important. And if you are a senior leader here, let me tell you, there is a lot of friction out there in the world of assistants and seniors. Some assistants just don't feel they get any help at all. I came across one at a leaders conference. He said, I'm assistant pastor. I've been in post 6 weeks. I've not met yet with my senior leader. I've no idea how often he's going to meet with me. And I'm like, why has he got you? What is he doing? Like, don't you understand that when you take somebody on, you are going to use up about 10% of your working week to help that person grow as a Christian? So in some sense, the collaboration comes from you saying, this is going to take quite a bit of my time so that the gospel can be blessed somewhere else. And then you need to help find and probably fund a job, especially if they're going to go into church planting. We've given away quite a few of our young guys over the years, and we've kept a couple, but we've given others away. And they're like children, really. I don't mean a horrible way. I mean in a nice way. When they leave, you have absolutely no say in what they do. But if anything goes wrong, and that's fine. But that helps collaborate. And that then brings on to the third thing. It seems to me in Britain today, if we are going to see churches planted in places where you can't strawberry plant, we have to collaborate. So strawberry plant, you can, like, oh yeah, we can keep on giving 30 people away. If your church grows, you can give 30 people away in money and a worker. Sounds easy in theory, it's quite hard in practice. But what about somewhere where you don't have anybody live? Or only one couple, like 25 miles away? How are you going to reach a place 25 miles away that's got no gospel witness? The answer is you've got to collaborate. Now, there are ways of doing it, aren't there? Movements. There are movements. Like, so Birmingham 2020 is a whole group of churches coming together. So let's plant lots of churches in Birmingham. Or Acts 29 is a church planting movement. And you get some training and help and some resources supplied. Crowded House is a sort of church planting movement. Sometimes the problem with those movements is you have to sign up to everything on the agenda. You might not be able to. You're like, oh, I'm not so convinced about some of this. Or what kind of freedom am I going to have? We have planted some churches. The problem about, for us, let me give you an example. Is Milton Keynes is about 20 miles from Bedford. We had one couple live there. And we didn't have 30 people live there. How are we going to plant in Milton Keynes? And Mark Lawrence, and who's at Dunstable, and Michael Toitch was at Flitwick Baptist Church, and Martin Hallett is in Bedford with me. We got together and said, look, on our own, none of us can plant into Milton Keynes. We don't have the resources. We have two people. We've probably got 10 grand. We've not got a worker. But the four of us got together and said, could we together do something into Milton Keynes? And by the grace of God, we were able to, the four of us together, pledged to a five-year funding. We all gave up some people. One church, an elder said, I'll move to Milton Keynes. Another church said, we've got three couples, our couple. There was a little nucleus of people there anyway that we knew of. And we collaborated to plant in a place that none of us could do on our own. And it seemed to me, in where I am in Bedford, we could keep planting within Bedford, but other churches have done that. Some are multi-siting, some are planted. But to be honest, the greatest need is Corby. If you were in Bedford, you go, Bedford actually is quite blessed with strong churches. And we'd want to see more people converted, but do we need loads more churches in Bedford, or do the churches in Bedford just need to grow by more people being saved? I think probably the answer is probably that. But Corby and Kettering, but they're out of our reach. We can't strawberry plant into Kettering. So the only way forward for many church plants in Britain today is to say, could we, as a group of churches, put some money in a pot, find some workers, and ask between us all, is there anybody either lives there or is willing to move there? We, years and years and years ago, I was an idealistic young man, and we'd planted locally. I thought, right, let's look on a map of Britain. Two most unchurched cities in the country, Hull and Plymouth. Very interesting, both working class cities. Exeter is posh, Plymouth isn't. Exeter's got some fantastic churches, Plymouth kind of. Quarter of a million people, in terms of percentage of churches to people, Plymouth and Hull. And I sort of thought, right, let's some of us move to Plymouth. And we kind of got everybody excited. And we had three couples say, we're going to move to Plymouth. Oh, we'll move to Plymouth. But that actually is very difficult to do on your own. Something happened. Some guy came along, and we put our money into planting church in French-speaking Switzerland instead. But well, that's a long story. But Stuart Olliott put a gun against my head and said, "Ray Evans, Mark Troughton does not speak good French. He speaks beautiful French, and if you don't get him in the French-speaking world, you will be accountable to God for the, you know, okay, Stuart, all right, okay, we're going to send Mark Trout." So that's what we did instead. We couldn't do both and. We had to do either or in that case. But at the time, I look back and think it would have been a harebrained scheme. But it needs to be done. So how are we going to do it? And it seems to me you are ideally placed as a gospel partnership to say, between us, could we not raise a salary, possibly two? Maybe there is amongst us all a couple that might move to X or Y, wherever you know your geography. And that was very exciting to hear you're talking about that, you know, let's get the map out. Where are there people and no churches? And it seemed to me that having gone through perhaps the last 15 or 20 years of strawberry planting, that's great. We need to put on the agenda collaborative plants, because otherwise there'll be communities that will never see a thriving gospel church, or it will be difficult to. And in the kindness of God, that church in Milton Keynes has gone from about 20 people, it's now up to about 80 to 100 in 5 years. It's great. Richard Boardman is leading it, it's doing well. We all could help a bit, but it wasn't like giving an arm and a leg away. Which sometimes when you first church plant, when you're 100 people and you give 30 people away, it just feels like, oh, crumbs, hard work. And actually, of the churches that do those strawberry plants, you probably do two or three in a lifetime. Because what happens is you give away core and you fill up with fringe, you give away core, you fill up with fringe, you give away core, come up, and you think, I haven't got any core left. And we're exhausted. And we just can't do it anymore. So it's probably two or three times in a lifetime. Maybe you could. You maybe do more than that. But you don't see churches do that 10 or 12 or 15 times. You just don't see that. Leaders get exhausted. Congregations can't take that amount of change. So, but if we are to see churches planted, we've got to collaborate. So I think hearing that you want to think about that as a group is very exciting, because it seems to me in Britain today, that's probably the way forward. Groups collaborating together. Enough of me. Any immediate kind of, we've got 5 minutes, questions, comments, reflections, anything from this morning you want to say?
Your ecclesiology shows through time round. Would you like to comment on, can be done in any denomination, any church?
Well, if you are an Anglican minister, you aren't allowed to plant into somebody else's parish. That's quite a complex thing, isn't it? There are ways round that. So Amy has stood outside and planted in places which otherwise wouldn't be able to do. So there's an ecclesiological thing there. Depends whose bishop you're under if in an Anglican system. Again, if you belong to something like Methodism, if you are an evangelical Methodist, you are in a circuit system which you inherited from John Wesley. So it means no church ever gets too close to its leader for too long before the leader's moved somewhere else. So independent free churches have a lot of freedom here that you might not have if you're in a more, if you're a Baptist Union minister, you might get into a lot of trouble with a Baptist Union down the road, even as liberal as you like. They'd still be cross and might make some kind of complaint. So is that what you was alluding to?
Just interested.
Just interested.
Is your training fund linked to your church?
Hmm.
And so thinking about a Church of England parallel situation.
Yes.
Off the record, if we wanted to make sure that it stayed for gospel ministry, even if the Church of England sort of makes it necessary to... Mm. To continue it outside that structure, you wouldn't want it to be legally tied to PCC. Do you know anything about?
No. That's.
But you wouldn't want it to be legally tied to gospel ministry in that place.
No. Yeah. So I mean, it'd be good to talk to William about that, because St. Helens have had to disconnect their finances from central Anglican finances, haven't they? In a way that, as a free church pastor, I've never had to worry about that. We are the only money that funds our church comes from its members, and we are accountable to the members how that money's spent. So we don't have to feed into a wider thing who has any control over. But if you're in a system where it's not just this is the way we do it, but this is legally how we have to do it, then it's very difficult. So if someone left, $250,000 to St. Martin's, somebody higher up the system will go, oh, great, thank you very much. Thank you, St. Martin's, for making that big contribution to our funds. And you think, well, no, it was left to us. So you're going to have to work very carefully around that, how that is legally tied up. Yeah, William would be good to talk to, because I know he's had to think that one through. In Scotland, that's caused a lot of trouble, hasn't it? So when the Tron Church came out of the Church of Scotland, I mean, premises out straight away. Well, we've just put several million pounds. Too bad. Belongs to us, not you, even though you were the resident congregation, came from your members. So where there are those bigger structures, some of these legal things have to be very carefully thought through.
Interesting. Tron already had a fund called the Epaphras Fund.
Oh, did they? Yeah.
Which was effectively a training fund that had slightly separate trustees.
Yes.
Who were then able to make gifts to
Yeah. That's right. So something like that. Yeah. So
you're going to say there are ways of doing it.
Yeah. Yes. So that's right. You just have to think carefully about the trust. Yeah. Yeah.
Is it possible to say something about the balance between getting ready for growth that God gives and catching up with the growth?
Yes. Yeah, well, I was talking earlier. We were talking together, weren't we? About Acts 6 is a fascinating passage, okay? At every level, there's so much. But the church is growing and groaning. And the groaning is not sinful groaning, even though it looks like it is, okay? Same word is used as the Greek and the Septuagint for the daily manna. Same word. It looks like it's a groan against God, but it is not. It looks like the same thing. It's not a sinful moan. It's an organization creaking at its seams. And they came up with, now, if you superficially read Acts 6, it looks like they're saying, don't distract preachers from their primary duties. That's what it looks like. Because you can make a case out for that. Like, you know, we must, you know, not wait on tables, but preach the word of God. And I've heard really good Bible teachers say, look, the main lesson of Acts 6 is the Bible preachers must not be distracted. But I don't think that is the main lesson. It is a lesson, but the main lesson is you will come across problems that you cannot solve by preaching at them. You need to lead through them. And you need to lead in such a wise way that you understand that this problem looks like it's a numbers sin against God moan, but it is not. It is an organizational mess that you have to come up with as a leadership team with a way forward that enables you to set your priority of preaching, but also make sure the widows are being fed. So what they do in Acts 6 is come up with a problem that cannot be preached at, and actually won't even go away by praying about it. It needs a leadership solution which involves clear priorities for us. We are proclaimers of the word. We need to be freed for that. But the church needs to be so organized that it feeds its widows well. We'll set up a team. You choose. Who do you think should be on the team? People are chosen. This is the most... I don't think this meeting has never, ever happened ever again. They're all happy with that proposal. Have you ever been a members' meeting where you're all happy with that proposal? Well, there you go. Everybody's happy. This team are set up. And they say, we will hand this over to them. We will leave it with them. And there's a lot, there's a tremendous amount of wisdom in this. How do you get everybody on board? How do you give a responsibility to somebody where they really feel you believe in them and that you're genuinely not controlling them? Churches derail on this all the time. Some churches derail on doctrinal aberration. Most churches derail with Christians squabbling about power issues all over the place. So Acts has got a lot in it. We have to understand in our leadership, is this problem like a problem of growth, and we need to catch up? So for many churches, like, have we got a small group structure in place? Jethro, Exodus 18. Oh, no. Oh, we haven't. So you're now 150 people and you don't have small groups. No. Well, people at that size will begin to feel, I don't know who's here. I don't know everybody's name. I don't feel I belong. And the only way through that is some small groups. It's Jethro. You need groups of 10, you see. Because 150 is what's called the Dunbar number. It's the number at which people stop thinking, I will get to know everybody's name. About 150, that's the research. So some of what we have to do is, how do we make the growth we've already got, people feel this isn't bad. This isn't ruining our lovely church. This is, we want to see more of this. Because as you see growth, people say, we want to see less of this. Because we never get to see our friends, and never see you, Ray. You never visit us anymore. All the things of a growing church family, if you don't crack some of that, then people will not have an appetite for even more. And Acts 6 at that stage is an exceptionally helpful passage. And it's about size dynamics going on. There's a sort of an organization that's grown, but it is now creaking because it's not coping with the kind of growth. It's a bit, we know this at families, don't you? You know, amazing story. Bloke said to me once, said, I came across this lady, she didn't have any children. At age 42, she had twins. Oh. Age 43, she had triplets. And age 45, she had twins. I thought, my goodness. She went from 0 to 7 in her early 40s. Poof. Well, that's lovely, all these babies, perhaps not. But you imagine that. As that family grows, you're like, we need another bedroom. We need to move house. We need a bigger car. When that happens in a family, of course you make changes. When it happens in the church family, people go, oh, we don't like all these. We don't like it. We don't want all. You know what I mean? It's kind of weird. In our ordinary families, we go, right, we need a bigger car. We need another bedroom, blah, 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 blah. We might even need to employ a cleaner because I can't. When it happens in our ordinary families, we do something about it. When it happens in the family of church, we just go. And so the problem cascades on. And so the churches begin to plateau, because 120 people is comfortable. It's just comfortable. And you find that people don't want to get much bigger than that because it's very comfortable. And our job is to say we cannot stay at 120 when within spitting distance of this building. How many people? 15,000?
More than that,
yeah. So it's never how many people are in church, it's how many people not in church. So if there are 15,000 people within spitting distance of this building, I mean, I say to my church, on my watch, our watch, we are not going to stay as we are. It's heartbreaking. So, is there a lot more beneath the surface of that? Yeah.
Sorry.
Got to go. Time go. Yeah, yeah.